Chapter 5. Doctor, Wise Man, Teacher, Traitor. While Abu Musab al-Zarqawi sowed chaos in Iraq, and later, as the posthumous consequences of his reign played out, the al-Qaeda organization at large was undergoing a transformation of historic proportions. It was changing from a single centralized hierarchical institution into a web of affiliates, each enjoying a level of autonomy Bin Laden would never have tolerated before 9/11. As to the upshot of this phase shift, opinions vary, even within the organization itself. "We have become an idea, and we are no longer a group," was one senior militant's skeptical appraisal. But that assessment does not account for the network's continuing ability to work together to wreak destruction. Ayman al-Zawahiri probably came closer to the mark when he said that following the changes in its structure, al-Qaeda is a message before it is an organization. The message is both potent and dangerous. But so even today is the organization. Zawahiri was in a position to know. When American bullets finally found Osama bin Laden in May 2011, Zawahiri, previously bin Laden's deputy, suddenly became the ringmaster, charged with taming al-Qaeda's menagerie of far-flung and exotic affiliates. His complex personality is one of the keys to understanding the huge changes and challenges al-Qaeda has faced since bin Laden's death. Like many prominent jihadis, Zawahiri possesses a character riddled with apparent contradictions. Having been a pious, eager student who abhorred violence, Zawahiri wound up ordering suicide bombings and justifying the wanton destruction of innocent lives, including those of children. Trained as a surgeon, he traveled halfway around the world out of compassion for desperate Afghan refugees, only to begin plotting to use their country as a base for violent jihad. So fervent is he about the practice of sujood, bowing to the floor in worship, that a dark, irregular callus has developed on his forehead. Yet his long history of murder and betrayal in the service of his own political interests could scarcely be further from this image of prostrate piety. To his family, he is a doting father. Former underlings remember him as approachable, good-humored, and easygoing, with a winning smile. But to those who defy him, including his fellow jihadis, he can be lethal. Despite his carefully cultivated reputation as a grand strategist, much of his 50-year militant career has been a story of dismal failure. In al-Qaeda, he has been known as Doctor, Wise Man, and Teacher. The Islamic State simply calls him a traitor. Above all, Ayman al-Zawahiri is unshakably committed to violence in preference to politics as a means to achieving his ends. "There is no solution without jihad," he has argued, describing all other methods as having failed. "If I fall as a martyr in the defense of Islam," he reasoned, "my son Muhammad will avenge me. But if I am finished politically, and I spend my time arguing with governments about some partial solutions, what will motivate my son to take up my weapons after I have sold them in the bargains market?" Compromise, according to Zawahiri, leaves nothing but a legacy of despair. Ironically, Zawahiri's son would himself become a victim of his father's violent intransigence when he was killed in a coalition airstrike in Afghanistan. To other points of view, Zawahiri is simply closed. He is fond of quoting Sayyid Qutb, one of the leading Muslim Brotherhood theorists, as saying, "Brother, push ahead, for your path is soaked in blood. Do not turn your head right or left, but look only up to heaven." At the same time, he has condemned the Brotherhood for renouncing violence and accepting the people alongside God as a possible source of authority in a modern state. In Zawahiri's worldview, everyone fights either under God's banner or that of Satan. Through a hopelessly distorted interpretation of U.S. foreign policy and of democracy itself, he makes every citizen of the West into a legitimate terrorist target. Regardless of the method by which Western governments obtain the votes of the people, voters in the Western countries ultimately cast their votes willingly. These people have willingly called for, supported, and backed the establishment and survival of the State of Israel. The fruit of a tree watered by hatred of Islam and the Muslims for several centuries. The West, led by the United States, does not know the language of ethics, morality, and legitimate rights. They only know the language of interests backed by brute military force. Therefore, if we wish to have a dialogue with them and make them aware of our rights, we must talk to them in the language that they understand. This wording closely mirrors a statement Zawahiri made in 1998, promising to respond to the arrest of his followers in Albania in the only language the United States will understand. The next day, truck bombs exploded at two U.S. embassies in East Africa, killing more than 200 people. For all his fire and brimstone rhetoric, however, Zawahiri enjoys none of the charisma of his predecessor. On the contrary, with his intransigence and rudeness, he reliably alienates almost everyone he comes into contact with. A close associate of Zawahiri's, back in Egypt, noticing something missing in his friend, reportedly told him, "No matter what group you belong to, you cannot be its leader." On the social ladder, Ayman al-Zawahiri started high. His great-grandfather came from Saudi Arabia, eventually settling in Tanta, Egypt's fifth largest city. He founded a mosque there that is named after him to this day. Ayman was the product of not one but two families of great distinction. His maternal grandfather served as president of Cairo University and Egypt's ambassador to Pakistan, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia. A great uncle on his father's side was imam of the 10th century Fatimid al-Azhar Mosque and rector of its affiliated university. Another on his mother's side was the founding secretary general of the Arab League. Ayman's father, a university professor, had a reputation for being charmingly absent-minded. Ayman al-Zawahiri was born in June 1951. He and a twin sister grew up in a well-to-do suburb of Cairo called Ma'adi. As a child, he spent a brief period in Pakistan while his grandfather was ambassador there. His uncle, Mahfouz, was a student of the founder of modern Salafism, the dissident author Saeed Qutb, and later served as Qutb's legal counsel. The young Zawahiri learned a great deal about Qutb and his uncompromising philosophy from the stories Uncle Mahfouz told of the great man. In school, Zawahiri was a gifted student and showed his piety from a young age by reading the works of Qutb and other Islamist scholars. Reportedly, he refused to participate in roughhousing with the other boys and regarded contact sports as inhumane. According to a former classmate, he displayed a level of shrewdness well beyond his years. He was extremely intelligent, and all the teachers respected him. He had a very systematic way of thinking, like that of an older guy. He could understand in 5 minutes what it would take other students an hour to understand. I would call him a genius. When Zawahiri was in his mid-teens, the secular socialist government of Gamal Abdel Nasser began a crackdown on Islamists, especially the Muslim Brotherhood, of whose membership some 17,000 were arrested. The crackdown culminated in 1966 with the execution of Uncle Mahfouz's mentor Saeed Qutb. That same year, at the age of only 15, Zawahiri formed his first jihadist cell at his high school with his brother Muhammad. Both would eventually find their way into the terrorist organization that became Egyptian Islamic Jihad, or EIJ. In September 1970, President Nasser, his reputation shattered by Egypt's humiliation in the Six-Day War, died of a heart attack at the age of 52. He was succeeded by his vice president, Anwar Sadat. The new regime was inclined to much greater tolerance toward Islamists. Sadat seems to have assumed that by striking a deal with the weary old guard of Muslim Brothers, he could pacify the entire Islamist movement. In this, he was mistaken. Whatever the old-timers might have said or advised, the younger generation was still out for blood. Thus, as Zawahiri would later recall, Sadat's misguided policy, let the genie out of the bottle. As if to antagonize militant Islamists still further, within a few years of his accession, Sadat began aligning Egyptian foreign policy with that of the United States and making peace overtures to Israel. These moves were to exert a profound influence on the thinking of young radicals like Ayman al-Zawahiri. Outwardly, the future emir of al-Qaeda seemed to be living the sort of charmed life his intelligence and social privilege opened up for him. In 1974, he graduated cum laude from Cairo University's medical school. Following 3 years of military service as an army surgeon, he obtained a master's degree in surgery in 1978 and set up his own general surgery clinic on a floor of his parents' duplex in Cairo. Beneath the surface, however, Zawahiri pursued violence. In 1975, while serving in the Egyptian army, he seized control of his EIJ cell after its former leader fled to Germany. Around the same time, he made contact with bin Laden's future mentor, the Palestinian theologian Abdullah Azzam, who had come to Cairo to pursue a PhD in Islamic studies at Al-Azhar, the university of which Zawahiri's great uncle had once been rector. Azzam's theology helped shape Zawahiri's own rapidly developing extremism. Though still only 24 years old, Zawahiri was no young man in a hurry. He was prepared to bide his time until conditions were right for a successful and sustainable Islamist takeover of Egypt's government. But within a few years, history would show that not every EIJ cell was capable of such patience. In 1980, Zawahiri was doing locum work in a Muslim Brotherhood clinic in Cairo. One day, the clinic's director asked him if he would like to go to Pakistan to assist refugees from the fighting in neighboring Afghanistan, which the Red Army had invaded months before. Zawahiri duly traveled to Peshawar, a city a few dozen miles from the Khyber Pass that was already becoming a hub for those displaced by the conflict and a way station for fighters heading in the opposite direction. Joining Zawahiri in Peshawar were an anesthetist and a plastic surgeon. They claimed to be the first three Arabs to participate in the Afghan relief efforts. Conditions in the clinic where they served were terrible, and the facility was so poorly equipped that Zawahiri occasionally found himself dressing wounds with honey instead of modern disinfectant, a technique he learned from Al-Tib al-Nabawi, the prophetic medicine used by many jihadis, including, as we have seen, bin Laden. On at least one occasion, he ventured across the border with Afghan tribesmen to see firsthand the heroism of the Mujahideen, desperately battling the Soviet juggernaut with no air support and rifles that had been obsolete for decades. Not for another 5 years would the CIA's shoulder-mounted missiles arrive to turn the tables on the Russians. While he was in Peshawar, Zawahiri had another insight. The lawless mountains of Pakistan and Afghanistan might serve as a staging ground for jihad elsewhere. As he wrote in his 2001 memoir, Nights Under the Prophet's Banner, I saw this trip as an opportunity to get to know one of the arenas of jihad that might be a tributary and base for jihad in Egypt. The problem of finding a secure base for jihad activity in Egypt used to occupy me a lot, in view of the pursuits to which we were subjected by the security forces, and because of Egypt's flat terrain, which made government control easy, for the River Nile runs in its narrow valley between two deserts that have no vegetation or water. When I came into contact with the arena of Afghan jihad in 1980, I became aware of its rich potential and realized how much benefit it would bring to the Muslim nation in general and the jihadi movement in particular. A year after his first visit, Zawahiri returned to Peshawar for another tour of duty, all the while taking careful note of the ways in which this jagged region might offer safe haven for Egyptian Islamic jihad. On March 26, 1979, Anwar Sadat stood on the north lawn of the White House to clasp hands on an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty with Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel and U.S. President Jimmy Carter. It was an event that predictably sparked outrage among Egypt's Islamists. Determined, as he saw it, to break the insidious link between Islam and politics, Sadat cracked down on Islamic student associations and banned the wearing of the veil on campus. Not long afterward, Ayman al-Zawahiri began helping another member of his cell, Issam al-Kamari, a major in the Egyptian army's armored division, to stockpile weapons for a possible coup attempt. Zawahiri hid some of the guns in his own medical clinic, but he was not interested in quixotic gestures. His vision for Egypt was a Sunni version of Ayatollah Khomeini's recent achievement in Iran, a root-and-branch replacement of the secular political order with a religious one. He was prepared to wait until the time was right for such a revolution, and as objectionable as Sadat might be, that time had patently not yet arrived. Killing Sadat would be futile at this stage. Not everyone in EIJ shared his view. On June 10, 1981, around a month after Zawahiri returned from his second stint at the clinic in Peshawar, an EIJ cell, led by a serving artillery officer, Khalid Islambouli, assassinated Sadat in broad daylight during a military parade. Zawahiri would later claim that he had had no knowledge of the plot until a few hours before Sadat was shot, and that when he found out about it, he had voiced his objection, rhetorically asking the member who briefed him on the operation, "Do they want us to shoot up the streets and let the police detain us?" But as a prominent member of EIJ, Zawahiri was rounded up in the ensuing dragnet anyway. In prison, he faced harsh treatment. As he wrote, "The treadmill of torture and repression turned at full speed. It broke bones, stripped off skins, shocked nerves, and killed souls. It detained women, committed sexual assaults, and called men feminine names, starved prisoners, gave them bad food, cut off water, and prevented visits to humiliate the detainees." To save himself from further torment, Zawahiri sold out Major Kamari, the man with whom he had been stockpiling weapons, and turned witness against him. Eventually, Zawahiri was put on trial alongside 301 other defendants. Early on, during a lull in proceedings, he addressed the international television cameras trained on the defendant's thick-barred cage. In fluent English, with an impassioned voice that occasionally cracked into something approaching a scream, he announced that the defendants had been arrested simply for trying to establish an Islamic state and Islamic society to take the place of the dictatorship, corruption, and dirty business of the Sadat regime. Zawahiri and his fellow EIJ operatives, he told the reporters, are the real Islamic front against Zionism, communism, and imperialism. He went on to detail the inhuman treatment to which he said he and his fellow prisoners had been subjected, even reenacting one of the torture positions in which he said they had been hung over cell doors. At another point in the proceedings, the defendants lifted their garments to show the marks of torture on their bodies, something Sayyid Qutb had done in court 20 years before. "We are not sorry about what we have offered for our religion," Zawahiri declaimed. "We have sacrificed, and we are still ready for more sacrifices until the victory of Islam." Convicted of the charges against him, Zawahiri was sentenced to 3 years in prison, most of which he had served by the time the trial finally lumbered to a close. Toward the end of 1984, he was released. He had been a committed jihadist before his arrest, but his experience of prison made his determination as clear and hard as a diamond, and he became more and more convinced of the need for violence as a vector for political change. And he had apparently decided something else in the dungeons of Mubarak's Egypt, that the real enemy, as he told an American acquaintance who had converted to Islam, was the United States. Sooner or later, Zawahiri said, a showdown was on the way. By 1986, Zawahiri was back in Peshawar, once again treating Afghan refugees. At the same time, he was still looking for a way to rebuild EIJ following the disaster of the Sadat assassination by fulfilling his vision of using Afghanistan and Pakistan as a jihadi base. Occasionally, a famous Mujahid financier and recruiter named Osama bin Laden would deliver talks at the hospital where Zawahiri worked. Among other things, bin Laden lectured on the need for a boycott of U.S. goods to show support for the Palestinians. In response, Zawahiri offered the Saudi some free advice. If he intended to take on the United States, bin Laden would need to beef up his personal security. "As of now," cautioned Zawahiri, "you should change the way in which you are guarded. You should alter your entire security system, because your head is now wanted by the Americans and the Jews." This may just have been a ploy to get closer to a potential wealthy benefactor. At any rate, the United States was, as yet, paying little attention to bin Laden. But Zawahiri's warning evidently rattled the Saudi. The trouble was, bin Laden's own organization was not yet equipped to provide the requisite level of security. So Zawahiri helpfully offered the use of his own Egyptian operatives to fill the gap. And as a result, the close cadre of followers around bin Laden soon became predominantly Egyptian. The meeting between Zawahiri and bin Laden was the beginning of a very dangerous friendship. The two men soon found that their strengths and weaknesses dovetailed neatly. While Zawahiri's organization was full of grizzled veterans, but chronically strapped for cash, bin Laden's was firmly in the black financially, but still green when it came to fighting. In due time, Zawahiri became not only an important strategic advisor to bin Laden, but also, in effect, his personal physician, an important position given the Sheikh's repeated bouts of low blood pressure and other ailments, some of them possibly warning signs of the endocrine disorder known as Addison's disease. In the late 1980s, during the Battle of Jalalabad, Zawahiri would come to bin Laden's bedside in his mountain lair to treat him for various debilitating symptoms. Zawahiri continued to supervise aspects of bin Laden's medical care right up until the eve of 9/11. Yet Zawahiri was not the only one vying for access to bin Laden and his seemingly bottomless coffers. Ever since his prison days, Zawahiri had carried on a war of words with the blind Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, who was the leader of Jama'a al-Islamiyya, or GI, a rival Egyptian jihadi group. Rahman and Zawahiri had been put on trial and imprisoned alongside each other in the aftermath of Sadat's assassination, but the two leaders' intense enmity had prevented EIJ and GI from becoming allies in the fight against Egypt's secular government. Behind bars, the two emirs vied for overall control of the movement. In a notorious exchange, Zawahiri told Rahman, blind since childhood, that the emir cannot be a blind man, to which Rahman responded, with a phrase that in Arabic sounds almost identical, "The emir cannot be a prisoner." This exchange encapsulated an armed standoff between the two organizations that was to last well over a decade. Now, both groups had relocated to Pakistan and found themselves competing with each other for bin Laden's largesse. Their feud escalated, first to scurrilous pamphlets, then to open accusations of apostasy, a virtual death warrant in the jihadi worldview, and finally, to outright murder of each other's followers. Zawahiri would claim victory against the blind Sheikh, netting far more assistance from bin Laden than GI ever did. He is also rumored to have vanquished another of bin Laden's suitors, Abdullah Azam, the Palestinian scholar whom Zawahiri had encountered in Cairo in the 1970s. Rather than fight Muslim rulers, Azam wanted to focus the jihad exclusively on infidel powers like the Soviet Union, and he worked to persuade bin Laden of the wisdom of his position. At the time, this was anathema to EIJ, which was still training its fire on fighting the Mubarak regime. Zawahiri worked to discredit Azam, even spreading a rumor that the Palestinian was an American agent. When Azam was assassinated by a car bomb in 1989, Ayman al-Zawahiri, among others, fell under the cloud of suspicion. By the early 1990s, Zawahiri was firmly in charge of EIJ. At the same time, he was becoming deeply frustrated at the Islamists' apparent inability to make any inroads in Egypt. Even the most violent tactics seemed utterly ineffectual. In one typical blunder, EIJ had planned to assassinate the interior minister in retaliation for government raids on extremist hideouts and radical mosques. The bomb failed to go off, and the would-be bomber was arrested. In the midst of his frustration, Zawahiri began his journey away from Takfirism, with its concentration on local fights, and toward the more global brand of jihad advocated by Azam and bin Laden. In his desperation to rationalize EIJ's failure in Egypt, a new picture began to come into view, an unbroken chain of foreign manipulation of the Muslim world, from revolutionary France through the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement, the treaty by which colonial powers set the arbitrary national borders of the modern Middle East, to the establishment of Israel and its alliance with the United States, from the Yom Kippur War of 1973 to the Intifada begun in 1987. In the Gulf War of 1990-91, Zawahiri came to see the transformation of the United States from a mover of events from behind a veil to a direct opponent in its battle against the Muslims. This revelation was to widen the focus of his jihad by an order of magnitude. During the early 1990s, just like his Saudi benefactor, Zawahiri moved his organization's base of operations to Islamist-ruled Sudan. Bin Laden gave him $250,000 to set up a camp north of Khartoum. This, and several other donations from the Saudi notwithstanding, EIJ still struggled with money. In 1993, traveling under an assumed name, Zawahiri made a brief fundraising tour of mosques in California. But the proceeds of this trip were disappointing, amounting to perhaps no more than a few $100s. With EIJ in constant danger of financial collapse, Zawahiri despairingly confided in one of his lieutenants that the only option was ever closer union with bin Laden's organization. Indeed, as time went on, more and more of EIJ's members found themselves being paid not by EIJ itself, but out of Al-Qaeda coffers. Not everyone in EIJ saw this as a wholly beneficent arrangement. As one disgruntled member of the organization's governing Shura Council would tell Zawahiri, "He who owns my food owns my decisions." But it seemed that the two groups' galaxies were fated to collide, and Zawahiri, whose attention was in any case shifting to the global jihad espoused by bin Laden, was increasingly content to let it happen. Operationally, too, EIJ faced setbacks. One of the biggest came in 1993 when the Egyptian authorities arrested the group's membership director, along with a computer that contained a database of every EIJ member in the world. As a result, 800 suspects were arrested, decimating EIJ's capacity to operate inside its own home country. EIJ's response, a second attempt to assassinate the interior minister, flopped again when shrapnel from the blast was absorbed by a large stack of files on the car seat next to the minister, possibly one of the few occasions on which overwork has actually saved a person's life. 3 months later, EIJ operatives tried again, this time attempting to assassinate Egypt's Prime Minister Atef Sidki, as his convoy drove past a girls' school in Cairo. Not only did the Prime Minister survive unscathed, the bomb killed a schoolgirl, who was crushed beneath a door thrown by the force of the explosion. Facing a public relations catastrophe, Zawahiri tried to pay blood money to the girl's family. He proffered the lame excuse that the militants sent to survey the site thought that the school was under construction, when in fact it was only undergoing repairs. In a clear echo of Ibn Taymiyyah's 14th-century justification of indiscriminate attacks against the Mongol rulers of Iraq and Syria, Zawahiri wrote, "The unintended death of this innocent child pained us all. But we were helpless, and we had to fight the government. We had warned the people several times before to stay away from the pillars of the regime, their homes, and the routes they used. These officials are mixed with the public, and they take cover behind them. So we have no choice but to hit them while cautioning the general public. If we want to put the issue of the deceased girl in perspective, we must weigh her on one scale of the balance and put on the other scale our daughters and women who have lost their fathers and husbands for no reason other than that their fathers and husbands were performing the most honorable duty, the duty of jihad for the sake of God. The Egyptian public was scandalized. Protests erupted at the girl's funeral, with mourners chanting, "Terrorism is the enemy of God." It may be a mark of the desperation EIJ felt following this series of hammer blows that in April of 1995, Zawahiri agreed to work with his former arch-rivals, Jamaa al-Islamiyya, on a plot to assassinate President Mubarak. On June 26th, as Mubarak was being driven from the airport into Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, for a meeting of the Organization of African Unity, a number of Arab men blocked the street and opened fire with assault weapons from the ground and from rooftops. Bullets peppered Mubarak's car, but its armor held, and the well-trained driver performed a lightning U-turn and sped back to the airport. When he arrived back in Egypt's capital, the president gave a press conference at which he struck a defiant tone, vowing to continue the fight against terrorism. In the weeks that followed, Egyptian forces stepped up their efforts to round up EIJ members. By now, the growing crackdown was affecting the group, not just in Egypt, but around the world. In particular, those members who had stayed on in Pakistan after the Afghan jihad were being targeted by Egyptian intelligence, with help from local and Western security forces. In revenge, EIJ decided to plan an assault inside Pakistan. Zawahiri's original intent was to attack the U.S. embassy or another Western diplomatic mission. But it seemed that was now beyond EIJ's capacity to pull off. So the Islamabad cell turned its attention to the Egyptian embassy instead. On November 19th, two huge truck bombs tore the front off the embassy building, killing 15 people and wounding 59. Zawahiri would later write that this attack left the embassy's ruined building as an eloquent and clear message. It also marked the advent of a new phenomenon in Sunni extremist terrorism, the use of suicide bombers. In its desperation to rid itself of EIJ for good, the regime's tactics reached levels of brutality comparable to those of the jihadists themselves. In Khartoum, Egyptian operatives captured the 13-year-old son of an EIJ associate, drugged him, raped him on camera, and used this leverage to blackmail the boy and one of his friends into spying on Zawahiri and planting a bomb to kill the EIJ leader. Sudanese agents captured the boys before they could go through with their plans. When Zawahiri discovered the plot, he persuaded the Sudanese regime to hand the boys over to him for questioning, then promptly had them shot and issued a video of their execution as a warning to anyone else who might be considering betrayal. Even for the extreme Islamist Sudanese government, this was beyond the pale. The regime ordered Zawahiri and his associates to leave the country, reportedly without giving them time to pack. Zawahiri protested, complaining that all we did was to apply God's Sharia. With his organization now diminished to fewer than 100 members, Zawahiri became a nomad in search of a new safe haven. The stamps in his Sudanese passport, issued under a false name, revealed multiple trips during 1995 and 1996 to Yemen, Malaysia, Singapore, and Taiwan. Other reports from the period place him in Hong Kong, Bulgaria, Bosnia, Denmark, the Netherlands, and Switzerland, although at least one scholar suggests that some of these alleged trips may have been an elaborate smokescreen thrown up in an effort to confound the various intelligence services looking for Zawahiri. One potential base on Zawahiri's shortlist was Chechnya, where Islamist militants were locked in a murderous insurgency against Moscow. Near the end of 1996, he traveled to Azerbaijan, where EIJ still had a cell, and at 4 o'clock in the morning of December 1st, he was driven over the border into Russia in a minivan with two EIJ operatives, a Chechen fixer, and $6,400 denominated in seven different currencies. Less than 30 miles from the Azeri frontier, and still several hours' drive from Grozny, Russian security forces stopped the van at a checkpoint. Finding no valid visas in their passports, the Russians promptly arrested the van's occupants. Zawahiri and his companions said that they were merchants looking to buy leather and pharmaceuticals. Almost incredibly, this lie held. Even after Zawahiri's laptop was sent to Moscow for analysis, Zawahiri would later claim that he and his fellow militants had been saved by divine intervention. They were nevertheless convicted of Russian immigration violations and sentenced to 6 months, five of which they had already served by the conclusion of the trial. On his release in May 1997, Zawahiri returned to Azerbaijan, but not before successfully making contact with elements in the Chechen jihad, as he had intended all along. This small victory did little to salve the rage of those among Zawahiri's followers who had not endorsed his probe into Chechnya. The organization's Yemeni branch condemned Zawahiri's ill-conceived Russian adventure as a disaster that almost destroyed the group. By this point, the strain on the EIJ leader had become so intense that he had developed a peptic ulcer. With his leadership, his organization, and even his health in severe jeopardy, Zawahiri was left with little choice but to throw himself back upon the mercy of his old benefactor, Osama bin Laden. From Azerbaijan, Zawahiri made his way to Kandahar to link up once more with al-Qaeda. Yet again, bin Laden took him in. For a few years, Zawahiri was finally able to lead a relatively tranquil family life. His wife gave birth to a child, Aisha, whom Zawahiri diagnosed right away as suffering from Down syndrome. Though its strength was at a low ebb, EIJ still maintained cells in Yemen, Italy, Albania, and Azerbaijan. Back home in Egypt, however, the picture was bleak. Many imprisoned EIJ and GI operatives, worn down by years of brutal incarceration, were giving up the fight, taking advantage of a deal proposed by the Mubarak government under which they would renounce militancy in exchange for freedom. Zawahiri, safely at liberty 2,000 miles away in another country, publicly opposed this deal and urged his followers to continue their struggle against the Egyptian government. Many paid him no heed, and the jihad in Egypt continued to decline. At the same time, Zawahiri realized that in order to secure EIJ's line of credit from al-Qaeda, he would have to commit his organization once and for all to bin Laden's globalized brand of jihad. By January 1998, negotiations were underway for a joint declaration against the United States to be signed by the leaders of both groups, as well as those of Gamaa al-Islamiyya and two Pakistan-based groups. The fatwa, finally issued on February 23rd, restated the familiar anti-American gripes. The United States, it claimed, was occupying the Arabian Peninsula, oppressing Muslims, interfering in the Arab region, and supporting Israel against the Palestinians. All these crimes and sins committed by the Americans are a clear declaration of war on God, His messenger, and Muslims. The ruling to kill the Americans and their allies, civilians and military, is an individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it. Reviewing the fatwa's signature block brings yet another reminder that when it comes to the global jihad, the past is never quite dead and buried. Rifai Ahmed Taha, the Egyptian jihadi leader whose signature appeared alongside those of bin Laden and Zawahiri, was arrested at the airport in Damascus a month after 9/11 and extradited to Egypt. By 2012, however, Taha was free and helping to organize protests in Cairo against the United States. In the years that followed, he traveled to Syria to help lead Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's Levantine franchise, until he was finally killed in an airstrike near Idlib in April 2016. Many more old guard figures like him are still at large. Zawahiri would justify his own shift to global jihad on the basis that the forces of the disbelievers have united against the Mujahideen. The battle today cannot be fought on a regional level without taking into account the global hostility towards Muslims. America, he said, would desist from supporting apostate Arab regimes only if the shrapnel from the battle reaches their own homes and bodies. But there was no use denying that the fatwa directly contradicted the principle on which EIJ had been founded, namely jihad against the near enemy, the government of Egypt. For many in EIJ, Zawahiri's signature on the fatwa was tantamount to heresy. In April, Zawahiri called an emergency meeting of the group in Afghanistan. Tensions were so high that one attendee feared that the 25-year-old organization was seconds from dissolution and expected some members to start wrestling each other. Zawahiri, though, was unrepentant. "Stop digging problems from the grave," he told his irate membership. "Gathering together is a pillar of our success." But many still felt betrayed. In the aftermath of the disastrous Afghanistan meeting, even Zawahiri's brother, Muhammad, who had been with him ever since he founded his very first jihadi cell in the mid-1960s, finally quit the group. Still, Zawahiri would not be deterred. Even before the fatwa was published, negotiations were already underway for a full-scale merger between EIJ and Al-Qaeda. The merger was at last announced at a luncheon in June 2001. Zawahiri gave an intransigent speech denouncing the Egyptian government and calling for Sharia law in Egypt. But in reality, EIJ's Egyptian dreams had now been subsumed into bin Laden's much grander global project. "We must admit," Zawahiri wrote around this time, "that the Islamist movement's goal of establishing an Islamic government in Egypt is yet to be achieved. The Islamic Jihad movement, however, had not set a specific date for achieving this goal. It could take several generations." He pointed out that 11th century European crusaders occupied parts of the Levant for 200 years before being driven out, while the British Empire later occupied Egypt for 70 years, and the French colonized Algeria for over a century. Thus, he concluded, "we could affirm that the jihad movement is growing and making progress in general. It may retreat or relax for a while, but this happens because of the campaigns of brutality or during the periods of siege." Following the merger, bin Laden and Zawahiri conducted a joint tour of Al-Qaeda facilities in Afghanistan to cement the new arrangement. It was probably their last opportunity to do so, for those same facilities were about to be obliterated in a hail of American and coalition bombs. Among the members of Al-Qaeda's Shura Council, those who had recently arrived from EIJ had been the only strong proponents of the planes operation. But the 9/11 attacks would cost each of them dearly, and Zawahiri would suffer more than most. During the U.S. invasion that followed, an airstrike flattened the house in which members of his family were staying. Zawahiri's wife and one of his sons were crushed to death under the rubble, while his daughter, Aisha, the baby who had been born in Kandahar with Down syndrome, died a day later from a burst artery in her brain. Zawahiri himself escaped on horseback through the Khyber Pass to Pakistan and into hiding. Some reports suggest he may have spent time in Iran, but it is likely that his permanent base, as with other senior Al-Qaeda figures, has been in the Pakistani tribal areas. In 2010, Mahmud himself, almost certainly writing from Waziristan, was able to tell bin Laden that the deputy emir was well and his family is with him. In the aftermath of the Taliban's fall, Zawahiri's statements remain characteristically strident. At one point, he threatened to follow up the New York and Washington attacks with an equally devastating strike against Tel Aviv. Despite heavy losses from the fighting in Afghanistan, he insisted that an Islamist coalition is taking shape. On the other hand, he accepted that the movement would have to make tactical retreats to avoid further deaths and arrests, and that he would have to lie low until the time was right for it to reestablish itself. In the meantime, he thought, much could be accomplished by using the carnage of 9/11 and Al-Qaeda's other atrocities to inspire lone wolves and small independent cells. He wrote, "Tracking down the Americans and the Jews is not impossible. Killing them with a single bullet, a stab, or a device made up of a popular mix of explosives, or hitting them with an iron rod, is not impossible. Burning down their property with Molotov cocktails is not difficult. With the available means, small groups could prove to be a frightening horror for the Americans and the Jews." In the long term, the objective remained the same: to establish an Islamic state to serve as a base of operations in the heart of the Arab region. However, Zawahiri cautioned that this was not an easy or close target. The jihad movement must patiently build its structure until it is well established. It must pool enough resources and supporters and devise enough plans to fight the battle at the time and in the arena that it chooses. In the meantime, we must seek to move the battlefront to the heart of the Islamic world. In the years that followed, as it became clear that Al-Qaeda's leaders would have to endure a protracted period in hiding, bin Laden continued to insist that his deputy be copied on all important correspondence and frequently solicited Zawahiri's opinion on various matters. In addition, Zawahiri became one of Al-Qaeda's principal spokesmen, delivering statements in a leaden, hectoring tone, worlds away from bin Laden's thrilling, enigmatic half-whisper. In the tapes, Zawahiri gloated over militant advances in Iraq, threatened further strikes against the United States, and eulogized dead Al-Qaeda terrorists. But as the flow of successful new attacks against the West seemed to dry up, global interest in these statements dwindled to the point where Al Jazeera and many other outlets that had previously run them in their entirety now paid them scant heed. When anti-government protests erupted in Egypt in 2011, bin Laden toyed briefly with giving Zawahiri some kind of role in formulating Al-Qaeda's response. Other than that, it is not entirely clear what Zawahiri's specific role was within Al-Qaeda. It is possible that, like deputies in many large organizations, he simply struggled for relevance. Clearly, Al-Qaeda's ideology, its ism, remained strong after 9/11. Indeed, it gained many more adherents, especially after the Arab Spring turned into cold and bloody winter. But the real-world organization called Al-Qaeda had not simply sublimated into a scattering fog of dogma and theory. There was and is still such a thing as Al-Qaeda. To be sure, it has changed radically. Before 9/11, if you wanted to work with Al-Qaeda, to enjoy its largesse, train in its camps, benefit from its capabilities, you not only had to join the organization and pledge fealty to its emir, bin Laden demanded that you physically travel to Afghanistan. He called this practice making hijra, after the Prophet Muhammad's legendary migration into exile in Medina, the event from which the Islamic Hijri calendar dates all subsequent events. This was not only a matter of vanity. When Abu Musab al-Suri, the media fixer and author of a number of tracts on jihadi theory and strategy, asked to be let in on Al-Qaeda's future plans while he was living in Madrid and London in the late 1990s, bin Laden rebuffed him, saying, "I can't share this with you, as you are in the enemy's belly." After the fall of the Taliban, however, gathering together in large groups became all but impossible. Thus, power in the organization began to diffuse, flowing out from the central hub to affiliates in Yemen, Somalia, the Maghreb, and beyond. It would be wrong to view this dynamic as heralding the defeat or near defeat of Al-Qaeda. To assert that Al-Qaeda is finished, as various Western officials have done, is to ignore not only the grip of its message on the minds of thousands of disenfranchised young people around the Muslim world, but also the all-too-real power that still resides with Al-Qaeda's affiliates today. Today's terrorist recruiters prey on young men who harbor a sense of grievance that usually stems, naturally enough, from the humiliating circumstances of their individual lives. But these same recruiters are adept at taking those resentments and twisting them, via disfigured theology and grotesque conspiracy theories, into boiling anger against the United States and the West. Ayman al-Zawahiri himself started out fighting the Egyptian regime, but wound up firmly in the global jihadi camp. And even Osama bin Laden once focused narrowly on expelling U.S. forces from his own country of Saudi Arabia. By redirecting local anger toward a supposed global threat, al-Qaeda has been able to spread its countercultural message and anti-Western narrative to recruits all over the world. Moreover, al-Qaeda Central, the modern equivalent of Hassan al-Sabah's assassin castle in the mountains, remains important. Within the organization, members refer to the central command as Khorasan, a reference to the hadith about an army with black banners coming to conquer Jerusalem. Al-Qaeda operatives on the ground refer to Khorasan the way FBI agents in a field office might say Washington, meaning headquarters. Orders come down from Khorasan in much the same way as they do in the FBI or any such organization, and some field offices are better than others when it comes to following these directives. Khorasan plays an important organizing role, but it lacks the capacity to carry out attacks by itself, much to the frustration of many of its leaders. While he was still in charge, Osama bin Laden continually pushed for more attacks against U.S. and other Western interests, a desperation for action that sometimes assumed tragicomic proportions, as in the search for a new manager of global terrorism, in which the Sheikh, like the human resources department of a small business, looking to expand into new markets, solicited from each applicant a resume and cover letter outlining his plans for developing al-Qaeda's capabilities. By the time of bin Laden's death, there was no getting away from the fact that power had become decentralized. In order to strike its enemies, whether near or far, al-Qaeda had become increasingly reliant on affiliates and lone wolves. It is telling that the two biggest attacks in the West in the years immediately following 9/11, the train bombings in Madrid and London, were carried out by tiny independent cells with little, if any, connection to Khorasan or its affiliates. In corporate terms, we might say that al-Qaeda was no longer Starbucks, with multiple branches all managed centrally. Instead, it was now McDonald's, with a proliferation of independent franchises receiving guidance from headquarters that could be more specific or less so, depending on the situation. In fact, bin Laden increasingly encouraged franchises to drop the name al-Qaeda, lest they draw unwanted Western attention. Several affiliates followed this advice. For example, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula rebranded itself as Ansar al-Sharia, partisans of Islamic law, to gain acceptance among Yemenis. Like any diligent CEO facing a public relations crisis, at one point, bin Laden had even considered rebranding al-Qaeda as a whole with a new name, something more inclusive and more recognizably Islamic than simply the base. Zawahiri would continue this tradition by advising al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's Syrian franchise, to split off from the parent organization in hopes of making al-Nusra more acceptable both to Syrians themselves and to foreign governments looking for an effective proxy for which to end the Syrian civil war. In July 2016, al-Nusra did, in fact, announce that it was leaving al-Qaeda and renaming itself Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, or the Levantine Conquest Front. But this split, like AQAP's rebranding exercise, was no more than window dressing. The organization's commitment to the ideology of bin Ladenism remained, as did its individual members' bayats to al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's franchisees shared a common ultimate goal, the establishment of an Islamic state, but they had radically different ideas about how, and in particular how quickly, to go about achieving that goal. For his part, bin Laden counseled patience. He continued to believe that there was no point in seeking to establish an Islamic state while America still had the military muscle and political sway over local governments to smother such a state in the cradle. until such time as it could be declawed, therefore, the United States remained the primary adversary. In fact, Al-Qaeda's standard playbook for establishing the Islamic State was well known in jihadi circles. It had been discussed at great length in two extremely influential works, both published in 2004. The first of these, entitled The Management of Savagery, the Most Critical Stage Through Which the Ummah Will Pass, appeared in the online Al-Qaeda magazine South Al-Jihad under the pseudonym Abu Bakr Naji. Whoever wrote it, and many theories have been propounded, the book sets out a strategy that is closely aligned with official Al-Qaeda doctrine. The problem, Naji insists, is not with the use of violence itself. Indeed, he claims that the most extreme forms of terrorist brutality are necessary to create regions of savagery in which the writ of traditional nation-states does not run. The term savagery refers to something like the Latin concept of barbarianism, which Imperial Rome used to describe areas and people outside its zone of control, such as the Germanic tribes that rebelled against Roman rule and would eventually topple the Western Empire in the 5th century. The management of savagery proposed the creation of similar savage power vacuums into which Islamist armies could march. The next stage, according to Naji, is justifying jihadi rule rationally and through the Sharia, not to the West, nor to any governmental authority, but directly to Muslims themselves, in a way that makes the cause seem right, even inevitable, and draws in more and more recruits. One of the keys to this process of justification, Naji tells his readers, is to provide the people under the state's jurisdiction with fair, efficient governance based on the precepts of Sharia law. Once the people's support is assured, permanent governmental structures can be established. The management of savagery playbook, therefore, proceeds in three phases. Phase one involves creating and exploiting chaos, or savagery. Phase two entails building popular support for Salafi jihadi rule. Not until phase three do we reach the establishment of a permanent Islamic state. Around the same time, a veteran Syrian jihadist, Abu Musab al-Suri, was publishing his own work on the same subject, a magisterial tome of 1,600 pages entitled The Call of the Global Islamic Resistance. The work is profoundly shaped by al-Suri's personal history. After having fought in the failed Muslim Brotherhood revolt against Bashar Assad's father, Hafez, in the early 1980s, he sought asylum in Europe, where he became increasingly critical of jihadi strategy, particularly in Algeria, where he witnessed from afar an insurgency alienating public support by imposing policies that were simply too extreme for the local population. From exile, al-Suri wrote prolifically on jihadi theory. Ayman al-Zawahiri called him the professor of the Mujahideen. His most influential book, The Call of the Global Islamic Resistance, stresses the importance of having local populations on board. The Islamic movement, al-Suri writes, can only establish the Muslim society through a popular jihad. In line with bin Laden's own thinking, he also emphasizes the need to rid the Muslim world of the United States before taking on local leaders. The old strategic goal of confronting governments has changed. Establishing the rule of the law of God will result from the success of the resistance in bringing down the downfall of the greatest power, America. Both the management of savagery and the call of the global Islamic resistance remain popular playbooks among today's jihadis. But over the past two decades, actual attempts to create Islamic states have hewed much more closely to the timetable set out in a third work from the same period, a book called Al-Zarqawi, The Second Generation of Al-Qaeda, published in 2005 by the Jordanian Islamist writer Fuad Hussein. As its title suggests, the book bills itself as a biography of the founder of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. In fact, it presents an ambitious seven-stage, two-decade strategy for re-establishing the caliphate and ushering in the end of days, in the process of which the forces of righteous Islam will finally vanquish the apostates and infidels. Part 1. The Awakening, which involves shocking the Islamic world out of its long dormancy, had already occurred when the book was published, in the shape of 9/11 and the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Part 2, Eye-Opening, was also well underway, with the Iraq War functioning as a magnet, drawing young Muslims eager to die for the cause and kill Americans. Part 3, Arising and Standing Up, scheduled for 2007 to 2010, was to involve jihadis turning their attention to, among other places, Syria. Part 4, concluding in 2013, would see the fall of existing governments throughout the Arab world, in a process much like the real-life Arab Spring. Part 5 would culminate in the declaration of a new caliphate in 2016, something the Islamic State managed a good 2 years ahead of schedule. Part 6 was to witness a total confrontation between true believers and their apostate and infidel opponents. The final stage would be the worldwide rule of the refounded caliphate. It goes without saying that this accelerated timetable, from drowsy indolence to world domination in under 20 years, is wildly out of line with the gradualism typically advocated by bin Laden and other top echelon al-Qaeda commanders and theoreticians. Yet, in the decade following the 2003 invasion of Iraq, a number of al-Qaeda offshoots would try to establish Islamic states, and they would do so on a schedule much closer to this one than to those of either Najee or al-Suri. Each of these attempts would ignore bin Laden's advice to exercise prudent restraint and avoid attracting foreign attention. On the contrary, they would seek to impose an extreme conception of Sharia with medieval harshness and draw interventions from powerful outside forces. Each of them would fail. It began in Iraq. Just over 4 months after Zarqawi's death in a U.S. airstrike, his acolytes proclaimed themselves the Islamic State of Iraq. Initially, to curry support from Iraqi Sunnis, ISI pretended that its goal was merely to establish a safe haven for their sect, a necessary counterweight to the regime of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's Shia-dominated government in the south and the Kurdish zone of control in the north. But behind the scenes, and occasionally in public, its backers would articulate a much grander vision. They called the Islamic State of Iraq's titular ruler Commander of the Faithful, a title traditionally held by caliphs, and they sought to establish his descent from the Prophet Muhammad, another traditional sine qua non for anyone aspiring to rule as caliph. Khorasan had repeatedly shown its inability to control Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, but now Zarqawi was dead, no doubt much to the relief of the al-Qaeda brass. Perhaps they might have thought they would have better luck with the new leadership. On paper, the leader of the Islamic State of Iraq was an Iraqi going by the nom de guerre Abu Omar al-Baghdadi. But Abu Omar was a nobody. Even his kunya, al-Baghdadi, was a lie. It was meant to suggest that he hailed from the Iraqi capital, a fitting background, ISI believed, for the successor of the Abbasid royal family, which had ruled from Baghdad for over half a millennium. In fact, Abu Omar was from a small town out in the sticks, 130 miles from the big city. He had served as a police officer in his hometown until he was dismissed when his religious extremism became too vocal for his superiors to stomach. For a while, he became an electronics repairman before joining the insurgency in the run-up to the invasion. One ISI operative described Abu Omar as nothing but a regular militant, with questionable qualifications and no right to the allegiance of anyone, much less the top leaders of ISI's constituent groups. The real leader, and the true successor to Zarqawi, was an Egyptian by the name of Abu Hamza al-Muhajir. His kunya, which translates as the immigrant, suggests why ISI felt it necessary to mask him with a local figurehead. Officially, Muhajir was war minister in Abu Omar's cabinet, In reality, he was the one pulling the strings. Muhajir had an incomparably longer history in the jihad than Abu Omar and had been much closer to the al-Qaeda leadership than Zarqawi ever was. In 1982, he had joined Egyptian Islamic Jihad, the organization in which Ayman al-Zawahiri had made his name, and which he would later come to lead. Muhajir traveled to Afghanistan alongside Zawahiri and trained in al-Qaeda's camps there. In early 2003, Zawahiri sent Muhajir to Iraq. A year and a half later, with Zarqawi's merger into al-Qaeda, Muhajir began working for the Jordanian. Initial signs were encouraging for Khorasan. Within a few days of Zarqawi's death, Muhajir had issued a statement reiterating his loyalty to bin Laden and to al-Qaeda. "We are an arrow in your quiver," he told the Sheikh. "Shoot us where you wish." Yet just 4 months later, Muhajir had signed off on the creation of the Islamic State of Iraq, and a month after that, he had unilaterally disbanded al-Qaeda in Iraq, dissolved his forces into the Islamic State of Iraq, and pledged bayat to Abu Omar on behalf of himself and all his followers. Khorasan had authorized none of these developments and cannot have been pleased with any of them. But Muhajir had presented the al-Qaeda brass with a fait accompli that they were forced to accept. Bin Laden, Zawahiri, and the other leaders remained as mindful as ever of the need to keep a toehold in Iraq. Publicly, therefore, they issued statement after statement in support of ISI. Privately, however, they continued to be irritated, if not outright alarmed, by the excesses of Muhajir and his cronies. Zawahiri continually demanded that Muhajir explain what was going on, but these requests went unheeded. Relations became so strained that some senior members even began to counsel bin Laden to cut ties with ISI, believing that the association was now doing al-Qaeda more harm than good. But in public, al-Qaeda maintained the charade that it approved of what its Iraqi arm was doing. The Islamic State of Iraq remained a potent terrorist force. Well over a year after his death, Zarqawi's erstwhile followers remained capable of violence on a mass scale, such as the string of coordinated truck bombs that killed more than 500 people in August 2007 in the deadliest day of the entire Iraq War. The group crushed dissent with an iron fist, frequently murdering jihadis and others who refused to bend the knee to Abu Omar. But as a governing political entity, the Islamic State of Iraq was, like its cardboard emir, no more than a tenuous fiction. Many of its operatives and even its senior leadership were too drunk on heady talk of the impending end of days to function effectively as anything other than a killing machine. Some rank-and-file al-Qaeda members, like Abu Jandal, were fond of spouting supposed end-times hadith, and the organization happily fed their obsession with its own symbolism, for example referring to its high command as Khorasan, based, as we have seen, on the Black Banner's hadith, and calling Al-Nusra's house magazine after the white minaret in Damascus, where Jesus was supposed to appear immediately before the apocalypse. But official al-Qaeda doctrine saw these events as happening far in the future, decades or generations hence. Khorasan had repeatedly warned Muhajir against indulging in apocalyptic rhetoric implying that the end was nigh, telling him such talk was very dangerous and corrupts policy and leadership. For al-Qaeda, the management of savagery playbook had to be followed. Build public support first, then a state, then think about what comes next. But Muhajir insisted again and again, apparently without irony or conscious exaggeration, that he expected the arrival of the Mahdi, the Islamic Messiah, any day. Meanwhile, the Islamic State of Iraq, under Muhajir, shamelessly exaggerated its achievements, even to the extent of faking operations in its propaganda films by splicing together old footage. It was an open secret that Abu Omar was a paper tiger. But even his real boss, Abu Hamza al-Muhajir, was said to have isolated himself from the battlefield. The former chief judge of the Islamic State of Iraq, who was so concerned about Muhajir's shaky leadership that he fled to Pakistan to seek Khorasan's intercession, told al-Qaeda leaders that Muhajir was totally isolated, barely seeing or seen by anyone, and that he was too weak to deal with corruption among his own lieutenants. Muhajir routinely sent fighters to their deaths on absurdly dangerous missions with no real chance of success, such as an ill-timed assault on the city of Ramadi. Worst of all, the Islamic State of Iraq, supposedly the successor to one of the greatest land empires in history, controlled no territory worthy of the name. Its leaders cowered in the wastes of Anbar province in an effort to evade the attention of the Americans and the Sunni awakening groups. Muhajir's own wife is said to have chided him about this, on at least one occasion screaming, "Where is this Islamic State of Iraq you're talking about? We live in the desert." Bin Laden, al-Suri, and the pseudonymous author of The Management of Savagery had warned again and again of the danger of proceeding without public support. But ISI not only did not enjoy such support, it had seemingly gone out of its way to alienate vast swaths of the Iraqi population. Its leaders were obviously corrupt, and the local populace grew understandably enraged at being pushed around by foreign thugs fighting for ISI. Nor did the group's slate of policies do much to endear it to many Iraqis. In a March 2007 audio statement entitled "Some of Our Fundamentals," Abu Omar called for bans on statues, tombs, and satellite television, demanded that women be veiled and refrain from mixing with men, called Shia Muslims idolaters and apostates, condemned anyone who helped the Americans, worked for the Iraqi government or in any way participated in the political process, and demanded that Christians and Jews pay a protection tax on pain of death. In areas temporarily under its control, ISI imposed beheadings, amputations, and deadly stonings, reportedly even against children. Anyone who dared to resist would be pronounced an infidel or apostate and risked being killed. Almost the only people Muhajir bothered to avoid alienating were other militants. When another al-Qaeda-aligned group complained about his conduct, he issued a groveling apology, saying that he would carry your shoes on my head and kiss them 1,000 times. Even by the standards of terrorist fanatics, the diabolical levels of violence visited on Iraq by the Islamic State of Iraq went way beyond what was acceptable. A reckoning for its crimes was long overdue. When the Islamic State of Iraq was proclaimed, its leaders had said they enjoyed the backing of at least 60% of Sunni tribal elders within its sphere of influence. Even at the time, that was probably a gross exaggeration, if not an outright lie. Since then, its relentless brutality had eroded that natural support base so comprehensively that local Sunni armed groups had started working with the Shia-led government and the Americans themselves to destroy the Islamic State of Iraq once and for all. At its height, the Sunni Awakening co-opted more than 100,000 Sunni fighters to battle ISI. Meanwhile, the U.S. surge put 30,000 additional American boots on the ground. As a result, the state was pummeled. Indeed, it was almost extinguished altogether by a relentless series of defeats, deaths, and arrests. By the close of 2007, it was facing what one high-level internal analysis called an extraordinary crisis. Bin Laden issued a backs-to-the-wall audio statement in which he admitted that the malice has increased and the darkness has become pitch black, and called for more recruits from elsewhere in the Muslim world, attempting to entice them with the dubious inducement that being stabbed in the throat is more honorable than being stabbed in the back. Other affiliates, it is fair to say, presented less of a headache for Khorasan. In Yemen, his family's ancestral homeland, Bin Laden had long seen a potential battleground, recruiting station, and safe house for the global jihad. In addition, of course, he harbored a long-standing grudge against the regime in the neighboring country to the north, his homeland of Saudi Arabia. So it is perhaps unsurprising that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP, the organization's affiliate in Yemen and Saudi Arabia, has long been the closest to Al-Qaeda Central in terms both of ideology and organization. In sharp contrast to that of ISI, all of AQAP's main leaders were at one point or another members of Al-Qaeda's Islamist model society in Afghanistan. Having been steeped in bin Laden's conception of the global jihad, these veterans understood his philosophy in a way that those recruited after the fall of the Taliban never would. AQAP was headed by Nasser al-Wuhayshi, a Yemeni and a confirmed member of the Al-Qaeda establishment. 20 years younger than bin Laden, like many jihadis of his generation, Wuhayshi had been inspired by the Saudis' anti-American statements of the 1990s and had traveled to Afghanistan to join his hero. With conspicuous intelligence and aptitude, and no small measure of self-deprecating humor, Wuhayshi rose quickly to become a member of bin Laden's inner circle, eventually serving as the emir's chief of staff. Wuhayshi recruited into Al-Qaeda a number of his fellow Yemenis, including Fahd al-Kusso, who would go on to participate in the 2000 bombing of the USS Cole while it lay at anchor in the Yemeni port of Aden. Wuhayshi stuck with bin Laden through the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and fought against American special forces at the Battle of Tora Bora in late 2001. After fleeing to Iran, he was apprehended and deported to face terrorism charges back home in Yemen. But in February 2006, he helped lead 24 jihadis in an audacious escape, in the course of which they tunneled into the women's bathroom of a mosque across the street from the jail. His storied background made Wuhayshi a legendary figure within Al-Qaeda. After breaking jail, he set about rebuilding Al-Qaeda's operation in Yemen, becoming its leader in mid-2007. Meanwhile, following a series of bombings, kidnappings, and assassinations across the kingdom, Al-Qaeda's Saudi branch faltered and almost collapsed under an onslaught from the Saudi security forces. In 2009, the Yemeni and Saudi Arabian branches officially merged. Wuhayshi was the natural choice to lead the resulting jihadi conglomerate, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Another prominent figure in AQAP was a Yemeni-American cleric, Anwar al-Awlaki. Born in New Mexico and educated at Colorado State University, by his mid-20s, Awlaki had married, started a family, and become a popular and at first relatively moderate preacher, first in Southern California and then in Northern Virginia. But unbeknownst to his family, Awlaki led a double life. He frequented prostitutes and, on at least two occasions, while living in San Diego, had been arrested for attempted solicitation. By September 11, 2001, Awlaki had risen to the position of imam at a prominent mosque in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., in which role he gave lectures at the U.S. Capitol Building and the Pentagon. In the broad investigation that followed 9/11, FBI agents learned that two of the hijackers who crashed American Airlines Flight 77 into the Pentagon had once worshipped at the San Diego Mosque where Awlaki preached. The agents interviewed Awlaki and put him under surveillance. The investigation uncovered no links to terrorism, but did reveal Awlaki's habit of visiting D.C. area prostitutes. In early 2002, another witness interviewed by the FBI tipped Awlaki off that the agents knew of his activities. Fearing arrest and humiliation, Awlaki fled the country, first to the United Kingdom and then to Yemen, where his preaching became increasingly inflammatory and anti-American. After a year and a half of imprisonment without charge in Yemen, Awlaki joined AQAP, becoming in effect the group's chief propagandist, as well as a mainstay of its recruitment efforts, especially when it came to recruits living in the West. His ability to speak flawless colloquial American English represented a huge asset in enlisting English-speaking Muslims like the 2009 Fort Hood shooter, the 2013 Boston Marathon bombers, and the 24-year-old Kuwaiti American who killed 5 military personnel in Chattanooga in 2015. All were either recruited directly by Awlaki or inspired by his preaching. Even today, years after his death in a U.S. drone strike, his message, delivered via CDs, DVDs, and YouTube videos, continues to prompt young Americans, Brits, and others to join the Islamic State. Aulaki's influence and Wuhaishi's connections, together with a prodigious talent for making millions of dollars from hostage ransoms, which Wuhaishi described as an easy spoil, a profitable trade, and a precious treasure, all played a major role in making AQAP by far al-Qaeda's most dangerous offshoot in terms of global terrorism. Among all of the organization's affiliates, AQAP was the only one that Osama bin Laden truly trusted with missions against Western interests. In the 5 years preceding bin Laden's death, most major attacks and plots against the United States could be tied back to AQAP or its forerunners, including the September 2008 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a, the failed underwear bomb plot against a Northwest Airlines plane in December 2009, and the plan to blow up U.S. cargo planes that was foiled in 2010. Yet even AQAP struggled at times to slake bin Laden's prodigious thirst for more attacks against America and its allies. In June 2010, AQAP began publishing its online English-language magazine, Inspire, co-founded, like its older Arabic cousin, Echo of Battles, by an eager millennial with an appetite for social media. Samir Khan was born in Saudi Arabia to Pakistani parents, but grew up largely in New York City and North Carolina, where he ran a jihadist blog under the screen name Revolution. Khan would later die in the same drone strike as Anwar al-Awlaki. His creation, Inspire Magazine, was designed to do just what its name suggests, to motivate and instruct wannabe terrorists to take matters into their own hands, preferably lone wolves capable of traveling freely and avoiding detection. Thus, in the first edition, alongside an exclusive interview with Wuhaishi, readers could enjoy an article by the cryptonymous Al-Qaeda Chef, entitled, Make a Bomb in the Kitchen of Your Mom. It seems to have worked. Inspire would go on to play a role in radicalizing and instructing, among others, the Chechen-American terrorists Jakar and Tamerlan Tsarnaev, whose pressure cooker bombs killed 3 people and maimed more than 200 others in Boston. At the same time, AQAP was also focusing some of its efforts locally, with attacks and assassination attempts in Yemen and Saudi Arabia. Like many jihadis, Wuhaishi harbored territorial ambitions. In 2010, in the midst of Yemeni tribal unrest bordering on civil war, he wrote to bin Laden saying, "If you want Sana'a, today is the day." Bin Laden replied with his trademark caution, "We want Sana'a to establish an Islamic state, but first, we want to make sure we have the capability to control it." Again, the Emir set out at length his long-held doctrine that America must be defeated first. Otherwise, the enemy continues to possess the ability to topple any state we establish. The Yemeni regime, though secular and incompetent, was less dangerous to us than the one America wants to exchange it with. Moreover, he said, patience in this regard might soon pay off. The United States would have to withdraw during the next few years for many reasons, bin Laden wrote, the most important of which is America's high deficit. The following year, when the Arab Spring reached Sana'a, AQAP took advantage of the ensuing chaos to occupy a swath of poorly defended territory in southern Yemen around the historic port town of Zinjibar. They did not formally declare an Islamic state, but in practice, they were governing, albeit branded as Ansar al-Sharia rather than al-Qaeda. AQAP did make an effort to provide services like education and clean water to southern populations historically neglected by the northern-dominated government. One tribal elder reported that whereas the government in Sana'a had reluctantly promised his people half a dozen teachers, Ansar al-Sharia had provided 16. Nevertheless, these ministrations were still accompanied by the usual round of beheadings, stonings, and amputations, sadly familiar from previous jihadi occupations elsewhere in the world. Bin Laden, as usual, had advised Wu Heishi to avoid antagonizing the local population, in particular the tribes. For now it seemed, as with the Islamic State of Iraq, that his advice had fallen on deaf ears. But AQAP would soon prove much more adaptable in this regard than al-Qaeda's wayward Iraqi offshoot. Across the Gulf of Aden in Somalia, there lay another long-standing theater of jihad. In 2006, Somalia's 15th year without a functioning central government, an Islamist group called the Islamic Courts Union, or ICU, conquered most of Somalia's southern arm and briefly held Mogadishu, before being ousted from the capital by Ethiopian forces a few months later. The ICU's brutal private army was a group euphemistically referred to as its Mujahideen Youth Movement, Harakat al-Shabab al-Mujahideen. Al-Shabab, as the group came to be known for short, would soon find itself galvanized by the Ethiopian presence on Somali soil into the most dangerous militant organization in the entire region. Al-Shabab is a complex organism. Many members are nationalistically inclined and locally focused, while some prominent voices hew more closely to the bin Ladenist brand of global jihad. For the most part, Al-Shabab does indeed keep its focus on domestic issues within Somalia, battling the embryonic Somali government as well as regional forces and United Nations peacekeepers. But the group also enjoyed strong ties to Khorasan through one of its leaders, Harun Fazul. Fazul had been a member of the notorious Mogadishu team of Saif al-Adils that precipitated the Black Hawk Down incident in 1993. 5 years later, he was part of the cell that carried out the 1998 East Africa embassy bombings. Within al-Shabaab, Fazul led a globally minded faction that was eager to give the group's bayat to al-Qaeda. In 2008, al-Shabaab did indeed pledge allegiance to bin Laden, but the sheikh urged the group, as he had done with others, to play down its links to global jihad to avoid losing local support and attracting foreign intervention. Nevertheless, the following year, al-Shabaab announced that bin Laden was its emir, and bin Laden, in turn, appointed Fazul as the overall leader of al-Qaeda in East Africa. Al-Shabaab enjoyed particularly close links to its al-Qaeda brethren in nearby Yemen, a country with a large Somali diaspora. A number of attacks inside Yemen, claimed by AQAP and its predecessors, including the September 2008 bombing of the U.S. Embassy compound in Sana'a and the March 2009 murder of Korean tourists posing for photographs at the desert city of Shibam, were carried out or facilitated by operatives trained in Somalia. And AQAP scratched al-Shabaab's back in return. One edition of Inspire carried a story inciting readers to violence against member countries of AMISOM, the African Union peacekeeping mission in Somalia. At the same time, al-Shabaab was becoming more internationally minded. In 2010, the group threatened to connect the Horn of Africa jihad to the one led by al-Qaeda and its leader Sheikh Osama bin Laden. And in June of that year, it began its campaign of attacks outside Somalia with a series of suicide bombings that killed 74 people watching the World Cup final at parties in Kampala, Uganda, a leading AMISOM member state. Like many local jihadi groups, al-Shabaab's narrative of grievance extended beyond Somalia and its neighbors to encompass the West in general and the United States in particular. Al-Shabaab's propaganda twisted U.S. airstrikes targeting al-Qaeda terrorists operating in Somalia into evidence of an American war on Muslims. The group began recruiting in Somali diaspora communities in the Middle East, Europe, and the United States, promising disillusioned young men victory or martyrdom. In October 2008, it deployed the first known American suicide bomber, a 26-year-old community college dropout from Minneapolis who killed 24 people at a government compound in Puntland in northern Somalia. But al-Shabaab's ultimate grand vision was of an ethnic Somali emirate, stretching from Kenya in the south to Djibouti in the north. By 2009, the group had conquered one of the largest jihadi territories since the Taliban, an area of southern and central Somalia that included the important port towns of Kismayo and Marka. Like the Taliban before them, al-Shabaab ruled without mercy or moderation. They banned movies, music, smoking, the shaving of beards, and the cherished local custom of chewing the natural stimulant known as khat. And they enforced their rulings with executions, beatings, amputations, torture, and suicide bombings. Reportedly, al-Shabaab fighters once stoned to death a 13-year-old girl for the crime of having been raped. Like the new al-Qaeda itself, al-Shabaab organized its roughly 7,000 fighters loosely into companies of 100 or so, capable of operating autonomously, a decentralized structure that made the group extremely difficult to pin down. Even if senior leaders were killed, surviving commanders could easily continue to operate. Once again, however, al-Shabaab had made the mistake of alienating the local tribal population with its repressive policies, something that evidently frustrated bin Laden, who gave instructions for al-Shabaab to be compassionate with the people, lest the citizens turn on the group and become an instrument for the enemy to use against us. The group ignored bin Laden's protests and continued its repression, a mistake for which in time it would pay dearly. On the opposite side of the Sahara, another of al-Qaeda's regional affiliates was wreaking havoc. Like its Somali adoptive cousin, al-Qaeda in the Land of the Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM, did not start out as an al-Qaeda franchise. It began life as the Salafi Group for Preaching and Combat, an insurgent organization formed to fight the Algerian government in that country's bloody civil war. The group's military leader, Mokhtar Belmokhtar, had fought in Afghanistan following the Soviet withdrawal before returning to Algeria. Like the Algerian insurgency as a whole, the Salafi group suffered many setbacks. In an effort to shore up its fortunes, it declared bayat to bin Laden in 2003, formally affiliated with al-Qaeda in 2006, and renamed itself al-Qaeda in the Land of the Islamic Maghreb the following year. To this day, AQIM's leaders, including its emir, Abdul Malik Drugtal, are largely Algerian in origin and are thought to be headquartered in mountain holdfasts east of the capital, Algiers. But the group's association with al-Qaeda brought with it a new global focus. While continuing to pursue long-standing local struggles, AQIM began targeting Western interests in its zone of operations. In 2007, it attacked the United Nations office in Algiers. The following year, it staged a gun assault on the Israeli embassy in Nouakchott, the capital of Mauritania. And in 2011, it bombed the French embassy in Bamako, Mali, and kidnapped French nationals in Niger. But AQIM's own experiment in state building would have to wait until the violent aftermath of Libya's Arab Spring. Besides its major affiliates in Africa, the Middle East, and the Arabian Peninsula, al-Qaeda also enjoyed ties with a clutch of smaller or less closely affiliated groups. In Chechnya, for example, the Caucasus Emirate, originally an outgrowth of the ethno-nationalist Chechen independence struggle, received funding from Khorasan and announced its relationship with al-Qaeda Central. Its fighters formed a small but powerful contingent in Syria, and a sizable chunk of the group would eventually peel off and pledge allegiance to the Islamic State, forming the Caliphate's Caucasus province. In its hub region of Waziristan, al-Qaeda Central worked together with a number of tribal entities to keep its people safe and fend off the Pakistani military. Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, more often known as the Pakistani Taliban, a broad group that had come together in December 2007, while not formally affiliated with al-Qaeda, also helped shelter Khorasan's operatives in Pakistan's tribal north. Al-Qaeda and the Pakistani Taliban worked together to pull off attacks like the December 2009 suicide bombing of Camp Chapman, a U.S. base in Khost Province, Afghanistan, which killed 7 CIA personnel, a Jordanian intelligence operative, and the base's Afghan security director. In addition to these affiliates and allies, by the time of bin Laden's death, the broader al-Qaeda family also included groups of varying size and strength as far afield as Indonesia, Uzbekistan, and the Philippines. The organization was a far cry from al-Qaeda as it existed before 9/11, but it was still a potent and dangerous force. This was how things stood on May 1st, 2011. Then all of a sudden, bin Laden was dead, and Zawahiri was in charge. The interim emir, Saif al-Adl, did his duty. He secured bayat from all Shura Council members, and Zawahiri officially assumed the post of permanent emir in mid-June. Now Zawahiri was faced with a task that was at once more difficult and, in the new decentralized al-Qaeda, more important, corralling the organization's smorgasbord of global affiliates. Obtaining their formal allegiance, it seemed, would be the easy part. Almost before bin Laden's corpse hit the continental shelf, the troublesome Islamic State of Iraq had recognized Zawahiri as his successor. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who succeeded Abu Omar al-Baghdadi as the leader of the Islamic State of Iraq, said in a public statement, "I tell our brothers in al-Qaeda, led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, go on with God's blessing and be glad that you have faithful brothers in the Islamic State of Iraq who are marching on the path of right." Baghdadi stopped short of pledging allegiance, but it appears that his organization did offer to renew its bayat secretly, studiously following bin Laden's edict to avoid overt association with the tarnished al-Qaeda brand. Obtaining al-Shabaab's bayat may have seemed a more difficult task. Harun Fazul, a leading member, as we have seen, of both al-Qaeda and al-Shabaab, whom bin Laden had appointed to head up al-Qaeda operations across the Horn of Africa, had publicly drawn a distinction between the mother al-Qaeda organization and mere collaborators like EIJ. Fazul had made clear that, in his view, Zawahiri was not entitled to succeed bin Laden. This animosity might have posed a serious barrier to any pledge of allegiance from al-Shabaab, but on June 7th, just 5 weeks after bin Laden's death, Fazul himself was suddenly gunned down, reportedly when his car tried to blow through a Somali government checkpoint. Given the suspicious timing, and the fact that Fazul had historically also been a frequent gadfly to the leadership of al-Shabaab, at least one scholar has suggested the possibility that Fazul may have been assassinated by the al-Shabaab leadership at Zawahiri's behest. At any rate, within 2 weeks of Fazul's death, al-Shabaab had issued a statement pledging allegiance to Zawahiri. "We await your instructions," they told their new emir. 8 months later, al-Shabaab and al-Qaeda went further still in announcing their formal merger. By the end of July, AQIM, the Pakistani Taliban, the AQAP had all publicly pledged bayat. In his statement on behalf of AQAP, Nasser al-Wuhayshi reflected the dual focus of many al-Qaeda affiliates, swearing to continue the battle against the Yemeni government, but also pledging that "our war against the Zionist crusaders remains. It is as if we were only created to fight them and vex them." Zawahiri now had the official backing of the Shura Council and each of the most powerful affiliates. In formal terms, he was firmly established as Emir of al-Qaeda. But his worries were far from over. He faced an uphill battle for acceptance and relevance among al-Qaeda's membership at large. The first strike against him was his nationality. Al-Qaeda's upper echelons had long been dominated by Egyptians. They were the ones who had stuck by bin Laden most reliably since al-Qaeda's formation, partly because political conditions in Mubarak's Egypt meant that they simply could not go home. These men needed a means of support, and the wealthy Saudi was the best available. Moreover, Egyptians tended to be valuable recruits for al-Qaeda because, as even Harun Fazul had to admit, many of them came with valuable experience serving in their country's well-equipped, finely drilled armed forces. As well as the senior leadership, therefore, Egyptians made up a disproportionate share of al-Qaeda's trainers, senior terrorists, and military commanders. At the same time, many non-Egyptian members resented what they saw as the undue influence these men exerted over bin Laden. This was especially true among Arabs from the Persian Gulf. Back home in their oil-rich kingdoms, poor Egyptians worked for them. Inside al-Qaeda, this pattern was reversed. The Gulf Arabs in the rank and file tended to serve under the command of Egyptian officers. Even intramural soccer matches would often pit teams of Egyptians against teams of everyone else. To make matters worse, many old guard al-Qaeda members, like Harun Fazul, viewed Zawahiri as an interloper and a freeloader who had more or less conned bin Laden into giving him a sweetheart deal to save his own skin. Moreover, on a personal level, Zawahiri himself was not particularly well-liked. It was perfectly obvious to anyone who met him that he had none of bin Laden's personal magnetism. In conversation, his style was rigid and confrontational, and he had an unfortunate habit of trash-talking other members when he thought they were not listening. Writing before bin Laden's death, Abu Jandal, the sheikh's bodyguard, predicted trouble ahead should Zawahiri become emir. Bin Laden was a born leader. He operated with a transparency that made everyone accept him. He was open to discussion and had a historical legitimacy. Zawahiri, on the other hand, operates in secrecy. Many members of al-Qaeda will refuse to accept Zawahiri's leadership. His behavior and that of the Egyptians aroused a lot of concern and sometimes very lively criticism. All of this leaves its mark. Sometimes his ideas were rejected by other leaders, and I doubt he can command the necessary authority for the post, even though he is known for his authoritarian and controlling attitude. From early on in his tenure, events did not seem to be going Zawahiri's way. Just 3 months after bin Laden was killed, in May 2011, Mahmoud, the assistant of bin Laden's who had done so much on a day-to-day basis to help keep the organization humming, died in a drone strike in Waziristan. In September, Pakistani forces captured Yunus al-Mauritani, the man whom bin Laden had put in charge of waging a new terror campaign against Western interests. The same month, Anwar al-Awlaki, AQAP's Yemeni-American propagandist and recruiter, was also killed, although his sermons would enjoy an indefinite afterlife on the Internet. For a while, it seemed as if al-Qaeda might have been dealt a mortal blow. Not for the first or last time, however, the tempo of attacks and plots picked up once more. In January 2013, Mokhtar Belmokhtar, who had split from AQIM the previous year, led a new al-Qaeda-aligned group to attack the Tigan-Turin Natural Gas Complex, a British, Norwegian, and Algerian joint venture in the Algerian desert. During the raid, Belmokhtar's men took more than 800 workers hostage and killed 39 of them. In September, al-Shabaab kicked its deadly campaign against the citizens of Amisom countries into high gear with an assault and siege at the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, in which at least 67 people died. But it was AQAP that remained al-Qaeda's most dangerous global affiliate, especially when it came to plots against Western interests. In July 2013, Zawahiri further cemented the Yemeni group's privileged position within al-Qaeda by appointing its leader, Nasser al-Wuhayshi, general manager of the whole worldwide network, and empowering him to call on resources from any affiliate. Wuhayshi was now, in effect, al-Qaeda's chief operating officer. All communications with Khorasan were to pass through him. At the same time, Zawahiri commissioned Wuhayshi to carry out attacks on the West, and the AQAP leader promised his emir an assault that would change the face of history. AQAP set to work on two plots: a program of coordinated attacks against U.S. diplomatic missions across the Muslim world, and a plan to seize major ports and destroy oil pipelines in order to cripple the Yemeni economy. Fortunately for the United States and for Yemen's government, Western intelligence had been listening in on communications between Zawahiri and his COO. In response, the United States temporarily closed 20 of its diplomatic missions and bolstered their security, while Yemeni forces, with close support from American drones, moved in to foil the ports and pipelines plot. This time, the United States had been lucky. But the scale of the conspiracy and the economic and diplomatic disruption it caused served as a clear indication that reports of Al-Qaeda's death had once again been greatly exaggerated.